Good morning. All right. That was good. You guys have coffee yet? No, no coffee yet. Well, guess what? We're not going to need it today because we're going to go and dig into God's Word, which is always an exciting thing for me. So, a couple things. I asked you, what was the most surprising thing that you had in your life or something surprising that happened? What were some examples that you had?
When Daniel proposed.
I'm surprised you said yes.
There you go. Daniel proposed, and she said yes. I think James said the same thing, you know. And of course, the answer was it hopefully wasn't a surprise. Hopefully, you know. Usually, the women know what's coming, right? Usually, but you guys were both surprised. Oh, interesting. What else? Anybody else? Surprises. Praise the Lord. How many years ago was that? If I may ask. I may be so bold. Many years? Okay, I won't intrude. Never ask a woman her age and or other things like that, you know. All right. Well, surprises, you know. That's not my topic, my sermon here. But the text we're going to look at, there's a big surprise that's going to happen. Does anybody need a Bible, for one thing, before we get started in looking at the Scriptures? Everybody need a Bible? If not, all right, we all have Bibles, which is a wonderful thing. Well, turn to John chapter 2. We're going to be looking at a very familiar to a lot of us account in the life of Jesus. And this is actually going to be a very significant account. It looks pretty common, and it's actually a surprising day for the people in this story. John chapter 2. We're going to go through the first 12 verses is what we're going to cover today. John has been laying out actually the first week of Jesus' ministry, and we think that this is continuation of that theme. John chapter 2, it says, on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. Now, we think these are just five or six of his disciples because they haven't been mentioned. The rest of them haven't been mentioned yet. Jesus, the place Cana is actually probably about 9 miles north of Nazareth. So it's a close proximity to where Jesus actually grew up. Nazareth is probably about 500 people. So it's very small. Cana is probably even smaller. Usually you would grow up in the same neighborhoods or same area, and you probably had relatives in that town, you have friends, and so there's a small community. It's not like today where we, you know, drive across the valley and everything was kept in the same area. But Cana is going to be significant in John's gospel because he's actually going to mention the first miracle of Jesus and also a second or third miracle back in Cana. So Jesus and his disciples were invited to this wedding. And the wedding, I just have to explain, the wedding in Jewish time, the wedding was very special, okay? First of all, the husband, the bridegroom, we call it the groom, but the bridegroom would have been betrothed to the spouse, to the bride, a year before. And the betrothal was kind of like getting engaged, except it was more binding. You actually had to get a divorce to get away from that. You know, it wasn't like, you know, here's your engagement ring back, but you know, it was more binding. During that year, he would go back to his dad's house and begin either building a new house on the property or an attachment onto his dad's existing house. And it was at that time he was getting things ready that she had to get herself ready as well. And at any time, he can come back with his friends and say, "Hey, now let's celebrate. Let's have the wedding." You know. So you imagine that during that whole year, things have been prepared, arrangements have been made, you know, he's working probably every swing of the hammer as he's building on his father's, every day he's getting up, anticipating that day when he would come and fetch his bride. So Jesus is invited to the celebration, and the wedding celebration could last a week, and some say up to 2 weeks, but a week is probably more common of wedding celebrations. I'm sharing, when we got married, it was a couple of hours, Can you imagine if it was a week? By the way, you didn't consummate the marriage until after that was done, I believe, if I remember correctly. It was a week long, a celebration, and people are around. And so there's a lot of celebration here. And everyone would have been invited. Everyone in town would have been invited. Even people who didn't like you, you would have invited, because that was the socially acceptable thing. Even people that you're sort of enemies, right? You would invite everyone. Rabbis would be invited with their disciples, because it was like, there's a rabbi. Hey, we have a rabbi in the house, you know? So there was a big anticipation and celebration of this joyous occasion. It's a celebration. Verse 3. And when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Now here's the problem of the story. The wine runs out. Now that's not a big deal to some of us, but it's a big deal because the wine was a major element to the wedding. Now the wine specifically, it was fermented. It was alcoholic, but they would dilute it. The water is not safe to drink, and unfermented wine is too strong. Or fermented wine, rather, was too strong. So you mixed it. Say three or four parts water per one part wine, up to 10 parts water to one part wine, depends on the variation, you know. So it was a safe way to drink, and it was tasty, right? And it was a big part. And to run out of wine would have been a major, major faux pas. It would have been like, you're out of what? You know? It would have been embarrassing. In fact, the groom, by the way, the groom paid for all the events, not the bride's dad as it does today, but the groom himself would have paid for it, and he would have, if he ran out of wine, that would have been a major thing. So we can't even provide for my daughter enough wine for the celebration. That would have been, and the guest could have sued him. The guest could have sued. He would open himself up to a lawsuit. So it was a big, major deal. Now, Jesus' mom comes in. Now, we know that's Mary. But it's interesting that Jesus never refers to his mother as his mother. There's a point later on, his mother and brothers came to get him. They wanted to actually say, hey, you're crazy. And they said, hey, Jesus, your mother and brothers are here. And he says, who are my mother and my brothers? And he points to the people following him. These are my mother and brothers, those who obey what I say. He doesn't, he respects his mom, but there's going to be a change in this story of relationship between mom and son. In fact, he says, she comes in, and it says, the mother Jesus says to him, they have no wine. Now, we don't know why she comes in. Perhaps she was a relative. Perhaps this is close friends of her, but she had some responsibility or something, some vested interest to be the one that says, hey, they run out of wine. Now, up to this point, Jesus had not displayed any miraculous powers. He had not come out, right? He's lived 30 years in Nazareth as a regular guy. 30 years as an anonymous, just a regular person. He's God in the flesh. And to the neighbors and the family members, he's just Jesus, son of Joseph, right? He has not had this. He has not stepped out of the boat, so to speak, in displaying who he really is. And when his mother comes, there's a little bit of a tension here, because his mom is really saying, now she's probably used to Jesus taking care of things because he's the eldest son. Perhaps Joseph's dead. We don't know. We don't hear anything about Joseph after age 12, when he goes to the temple and he stays there and teaches. You know. We don't know what happened to Joseph. Perhaps he died. We just don't know. But we do know that Jesus is the eldest son of Mary and Joseph. And other scriptures mention his brothers and sisters. Now, pause real fast. And this is, we're just getting to the introduction. The Catholic Church believes that Jesus' mom, Mary, was always perpetually a virgin. And they say that his brothers and sisters were maybe from Joseph's previous marriage. But this, there's nothing in the text to indicate that he was married before. There's no reason for that, okay? All I have to say is she's used to pointing to Jesus. She's used to going to Jesus for help, right? The oldest son, hey, help around the house. I got a problem. Go shopping for me. Fix this table. Jesus, you're good with wood. You know, that kind of thing, right? So she's used to that. But there's a slight change in now the dynamic between Jesus and his mom. Jesus says, they said, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her in verse 4, woman, what does that have to do with us? Now, it sounds kind of harsh, doesn't it? I would never say woman to my mom, because I will get the back of her hand if I ever did that. Now, translators want to be careful because you can translate this word as almost like ma'am, like in the South. Now, ma'am, okay? They want us. There isn't anything rude about her comment. In fact, he calls her a woman even at the cross while he's on the cross, and he says to his mom, woman, behold your son. Now he refers to John as now, John, behold your mother. Woman, behold your son. He hands his mom off to John, this John that we're reading in this book, John the disciple. So the woman term is not a derogatory term. It's ma'am. But now he's doing this. I think perhaps Mary is expecting him to come in and do something very special or fix it. And he's saying this, my hour has not... What does it have to do with us? In other words, what's... How is this any of our? How is this our thing to deal with? Is really what do you and I have to do with each other? In fact, the demons say the same phrase when Jesus shows up on the scene, and the demons like, "What do we have to do with one another?" Jesus like, "How are we in the same place?" Jesus says, uses the same phraseology here, and here's what Jesus is doing. He's sort of saying, "Mom or woman, ma'am, my hour hasn't come yet." Now, she's hopefully thinking that he's going to do something special with a tinge of, like, now, show yourself. He's not going to be pressured into doing things her way. He says, my hour isn't come yet. And that idea of the hour is very special in the book of John. It refers to his time of his glorification, a time of when he's going to be crucified. John's going to use this throughout the book of John. His hour, you know, they tried to arrest him, but he slipped away, his hour had not. They tried to seize him, but his hour, they tried to make him king, but his hour had not come yet, right? The hour when, now my hour has come, God, Jesus says to the Father, now the hour has come, right? Now it's time, right? Now it's time to be crucified, basically. It's time when he's, who he came here for. So John is sort of hinting here in John chapter 2 at what's to come later. Jesus is also answering that and saying, my hour's not here yet. But here's what's interesting. He still goes along and does this miracle. He's not going to do it with her intentions. See, sometimes what we do, we push people to do things because we want them to do a certain thing, or we ask God, hey, God, now if you, we tell God how, we ask God to do something, and then we tell him how to do it, right? How many of you guys have done that before? Now here, God, I have this idea. You need to do this in this person's life, and here's how I do it. I have the perfect scenario, right? And God says, yes, I will do something, and no, I will do it my way. That's how God is, right? He kind of says, and that's what he's, that's what Jesus, at this point forward, in fact, at this point forward, you don't hear from Mary or from his mom until at the end of the book. So she steps out of now it's transitioning to, the relationship I had with you at home, you raised me, you know, has changed. Now, she should have known this at age 12 when he says, didn't you know I had to be about my father's business? She would have known that day was coming. This is my son is not, he's not just any son, and she respects his answer. He says, woman, what do we have to do with one another? My hour has not come. Verse 5, his mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Which tells you she's not dissuaded at Jesus' answer. It's, I know he's going to do something. So whatever, I had my idea, but whatever his idea is, you do it. This is the best advice that Mary can give to us. Whatever God says to you, whatever my son says to you, do it. You can have a life verse of whatever Jesus says to you, do it. Right? That's a good place to be in life, right? Is doing what Jesus says to you. Whatever commands, no matter how big or small, how insignificant or significant they may be, whatever he says to you, do it. And she leaves the scene. Now there were six stone water parts. What's a water part? Water pot. Set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. So you have, here's the scene, you have these water pots were used for ceremonial cleansing. You would wash your hands and you wash utensils. They had these ceremonies for purification purposes for the law. They're made out of stone, which means that they, see in the Old Testament, if you had things that were made out of clay, it could become unclean. But if you have something made out of stone, it didn't become unclean. Okay, they're filled with water, or Jesus is filled with water, and they're used for purification purposes, for ritual purposes. Jesus is now going to transform their use for a different use. It says that they contain 120, 180 gallons, whatever the math works out to be. That's a lot, right? That's going to be a lot. And Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water, so they fill them up to the brim. Let me just stop right here. There's all kinds of theories, and scholars can debate on all the spiritual nature of all this stuff, the fact that they're filled up to the brim, that means, there's nothing to void in what God does in our life. I mean, it could be like that, we just don't know. We do know this, is that John is not, this is not just an account of Jesus doing a simple parlor trick. Okay, and I'll tell you that in a second. I'll point this, there's significance to the story. Okay, in fact, let me read and I'll point this out here. For the Jewish custom of purification contained 20 to 30 gallons, Jesus had filled up water pots with water, so they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the head waiter. So they took it to him. And when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine. By the way, when Mary says, Jesus' mom says, they've run out of wine, it wasn't like they're beginning to run out, they're beginning to run low. It is, the Greek indicates that they're out. Now, we had this big party at, last Sunday, whenever we throw a party, my biggest fear is running out of food and drink, right? I don't know about you, do we have enough? Three more cases of water. We only have 10 people coming. Three more cases of water, because you just never know, I'm always concerned with having enough stuff, right? Because to me, it's better to have enough or more than enough and send people home with than having not enough. And you're like, oh, what do we do? Quickly do something, right? Here, the head waiter, of course, is a person who's in charge of overseeing all the events and making sure people are satisfied, and he's sort of like the host, and he's probably a relative. It says, when the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called their bridegroom and said to him, every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poor wine. In other words, after they had enough to drink and they're kind of feeling happy, they're feeling relaxed, they're satisfied, then you bring out the really cheap stuff, and nobody knows the difference, right? Is what he's basically saying. But you have kept the good wine until now. Now, John comments in verse 11, the story. Watch this. Look at verse 11. This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. John actually says this is the beginning of his signs. In other words, John actually constructs the entire gospel of John around signs, around miracles. This is one of them. This is actually the first one. In fact, go to the end of, John, is it John chapter 20. Look at John chapter 20. I want to point something out. Verse 30. John says this, John chapter 20, verse 30, therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these signs have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Here's what John says. I've picked out 7 or 8. Scholars have debated how many there are, okay? 7 or 8 signs. I've picked 7 or 8 signs out. But in fact, these are just some of the signs, many other signs. In fact, if you go to the next page, at the last verses, look at the last verse of the scripture of John chapter 21, very last two verses. John says this. This is John closing up the entire book. John 21, verse 24. This is the disciple who testified to these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, which, if they were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself would not contain the books that could be written. So here's what John's doing. He says, many other signs Jesus did. These particular ones are written for a purpose. In fact, if everything was written about what Jesus did, the world couldn't contain the books. So John is being very selective on the signs. In fact, here's John's point. Jesus did signs continually, constantly. In fact, the first several chapters that we're reading has sign after sign after sign after sign. Now, here's what's significant. Why would John pick this sign? Now, pause real fast. A sign is different than a miracle. Okay? There's miracles, which is a display of God's power, right? You know, like, the parting of the Red Sea, you know, it's a miracle. Or the feeding of the children of Israel, those are miracles, right? And John refers to miracles. Jesus refers to something called works. The works I do are the ones I see my Father doing, right? But John uses the word for called sign, and we get the word significance, or part of that, which means it's not just a miracle, it's a miracle that points to something further. In other words, there's deeper truths in the sign. This is not just a simple matter of water turning into wine and say, hey, look what I could do, you know? It points to something more significant. Now, here's what's significant is John picks this sign to start him off. And when he says this beginning of signs, this doesn't mean just the first in line, like I'm the first one, but rather it's a model for what Jesus will do. In other words, John is hinting at what Jesus' whole ministry would be like. Go back to John chapter 2. I'll show what I mean. When we look at this account of Jesus turning water into wine, that's great, he turned water into wine. But it's a picture of a bigger thing that Jesus intends to do. What is that? It is the work of transformation. The work of change, right? The work, it points to the greater work of Jesus, of God, doing something that nobody else could do. The water pots are filled with the water and can cleanse your hands for a period of time, but can never cleanse your heart, all right? There's six of them, which six is actually an incomplete number. Seven is a complete number. I think it's significant there that John points out that there's six of them, which means that actually John was an eyewitness because he points out these little details, you know? Six is always a number of incompletion. Seven is the number of completion. Here's what Jesus does. He takes what is ordinary. He takes what is incomplete. He takes what is lacking, what is empty, and he does something, he changes it around, right? Here he takes a scene, the wedding celebration, the wedding that's supposed to be a celebration has now turned into, they're out of wine. A big major no-no, right? A big major problem. He's turned that around from a point of, what are we going to do to, wow, we have more than enough, right? There's a transformation there. John is pointing out that Jesus is going to do something brand new. This is what the Old Testament promised, right? The days are coming when God will take that heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, right? God will fill you with the Spirit of God as well. Well, he will make that change from the inside, as Ezekiel talks about. This radical change that he will do. That's what Jesus is announcing. John's saying, here comes Jesus to come and bring real change in people's lives. Does that make sense? How many guys can testify the change that God has done in your own heart? The unexplainable change, right? The transformation that he is doing. I want to point out three things, and I might not get through the first point, because I want to reflect on this transformation, because it's significant here of what Jesus will do here and would do in the lives of many others. In fact, John says this in verse 11 again, back in John chapter 2, that this beginning of signs that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and what happened? And his disciples what? Believed in him. Now, I thought the disciples already believed in him. Well, they're going to believe in me even more. In fact, look at later on in verse 23 of the same chapter, John chapter 2, when he does his cleansing of the temple. It says, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name, observing his signs which he was doing. See, it's as a believer, we believe, and then God does something like miraculous that we believe in more, right? It deepens our faith. We'll get to that in a little bit. But I want to sort of reflect on three things. One is that this chapter and what Jesus does here, this turning water into wine, points to a greater work of Jesus transforming people, of Jesus actually transforming us. Even as believers, unbelievers get transformed, and believers, they believe, they see more, they change, more believe, you know, there's a growth. I want you to note a couple of things. First of all, the timing of what God does. There's a time when Jesus comes on the scene and does this miracle. It says, verse 3, look at verse 3 again, when their wine ran out. Jesus will come and transform a life at the least expected time. At a time when you are exhausted of all of your own resources. When you've basically have given up, right? It's that point when you've run out and say, what do I do? You turn to Jesus, right? You say, Lord, I've tried to fill my pots. I've tried to change the inside, and I just can't, right? He transforms us in his time and in his way. He doesn't transform people at our bidding necessarily or at our way. He transforms people, yes, at our prayer, but in his way. Here's what's interesting is that Jesus, though he's the guest, he's not the groom at the story, though he is a bridegroom for the church. He's a rabbi there. Here's what's interesting. Jesus works in such a way that he's the center of attention of the story, but he's not the center of attention in the story. Does that make sense? When the head waiter tasted the new wine, he doesn't call Jesus there. Which is what he should have done. He calls the groom, as if the groom had anything to do with it, right? How many of you guys have noticed that when God has done something in your life, you can't give credit to yourself, can you? People may say, there's something different about you, but you think, wow, I had nothing to do with that, you know? Jesus is the center of the story, but he's in the background of the story. Very interesting, is it, right? Like, if it was up to me, and I'm going to change something or someone, I would, hey guys, come here, come on, gather around. Hey, water pot's right here. Everybody, get the cameras going, Facebook Live, right? If it was me, okay, here we go. And he doesn't even say the magic word, so to speak, right? The change that God does is this hidden change, isn't it? At what point does the water become wine? Was it at this point? Or is it the point that the servants carry it, it's water, and then they're about, and as just as the guy's about to drink it, it becomes wine? At what point? You don't know. So it is with the work of God. It is hidden, isn't it? It's a hidden work of God that you can't explain. You can't say, well, it's a result of my memorizing all these Bibles. No, it's a change that the work the Holy Spirit does that's so hidden that you can't take credit for. Yet God gets the glory, right? You're like, I don't know where that came from. Something happened. I can say that to my. I used to get angry at that, but doesn't set me off anymore. What happened? Something's changed. That's the work of God. Does that make sense? It's not just hidden. It's such a quality that people take notice. Watch this. To bring, first of all, the water in these pots was not for drinking, right? It wasn't for drinking. It's for washing, right? Not necessarily for drinking. You remember, you didn't drink water straight. It wasn't like going to Costco and it was possibly not safe to drink, which is why they had to mix it. Jesus changes what is ordinary and almost unsafe, and he changes it completely different. It's not a little bit of water left over. It is completely different. It is such a quality that when the head waiter tastes it, he notices a difference. That's it. That's what it is like with Jesus, right? Where he changes your heart, you know it's not a work of you. They may think that you've done something different. What have you done with yourself? You sound different. You're nicer. You're kinder. You're more gracious, you know? Watch this. It is such a quality that God does in your life that people take notice and they're blessed by it, aren't they? The work that God does in your life is such a work that is not only hidden, but is such a quality that people around you are blessed. It's like, I want what you have. I want that joy that God has given you. I want that love that God has given you. I want the grace that he's given you. Now, again, we're disciples, right? We're learning, we're starting, you know, we're doing in steps in growth, right? So along the way, we may say, well, there's nothing different about me, but somebody who hasn't seen you in 5 years may say, well, you're different. It's the work of God. Here's what Jesus says, I'm going to transform your life more significantly than water turning to wine. That's the work of God. I don't know about you, but I'm praising God for that. That his work is of such a quality that people take notice, they taste and like, wow, I want what he has. It brings praise. He says, the head waiter says, not knowing where it came from, verse 10, every man serves the good wine first, and the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now. The head waiter responds to what he sees that perhaps he thinks the groom has done, when actually it's the Lord working in that situation, not realizing that God has done it. Does that make sense? That's what the Lord is. He's so, it's like we give him glory, but he's behind the scenes, right? You can't put your finger on, all you know is something's different today. Something has changed, right? I was running out of my resources. How many of you guys have run out of resources before? How many of you guys have run out of patience? Come on. You run out of love? I just don't have the love to give you. Well, you know something? You're right. Your water pots are drained. Your water pots are full of bitter water, right? But Jesus fills it up to the brim with something only he can do. That's why the love that you have for people is not from you, it's from him. That makes, I don't know about you, but that makes it a whole lot easier, doesn't it? Because if I have to gumption up the love for some people, I would, I want to love them. But what Jesus does in your heart is foreign to you. It is completely foreign to you. See, that's the work of God. That's why a church ought to be a testimony of what God does, right? You know, having times when we share, this is what God has done in my heart, you know? Or when I felt like I didn't have enough patience for a particular, or strength, or courage, or grace for a particular situation or with particular people, God supplied it supernatural. I was like, whoa, where'd that come from? That is the work of God. This is what John is saying. This is the beginning of signs that Jesus would do. It's true in our lives, isn't it? It is a complete change. It's no longer water. It's now wine. It's not a new and improved water. It's not like, you know, this water. How many of you guys are into the, we're into the, marketers are really smart, aren't they? You know, so you have like, say, spring water, right? How many of you guys are into the pH waters? Come on, no, nobody? pH waters? You pay extra $2 for something that says pH. You know, it's alkaline. Or it's from this spring, or it's from, you know. How many of you guys like our actual, our Phoenix water that we have here, tap water? You're a brave soul. It's not, the change that God does isn't like taking tap water and making it into reverse osmosis water. Ooh. And adding some elements of taste and flavor. Ooh. And then there's vitamin water, right? And then there's spring water, and then there's pH water, all this nonsense. It's water, right? What Jesus does in our hearts is completely, radically different. There's no residue of the old, is there? There's a change where God does something completely that you can't explain. You can't pick your finger on it. All you know is it feels good, is a blessing to people, and Jesus gets the praise, but people are benefited by being around that. Just by turning water into wine. So Jesus completely transforms lives. It's the beginning of the signs of transforming the lives of people. I want to look at a second thing, is that this not only points to a greater work of Christ, this miracle, this sign of turning water into wine, that not only points to a greater work of Christ transforming people, it also points to the ability and character of Jesus in the transformation. I love this about the Lord. The Lord is there, and he's there at a point when they've run out. I don't know about you, but maybe there was other wedding parties. Maybe it was other weddings in Jerusalem, and they didn't have Jesus there. And this one actually happened to have Jesus there. Can you imagine having Jesus in your wedding party when you're around? I mean, bonus, right? You know? His mom comes to him and says, they've run out of wine. And Jesus, of course, we said this before, he sets the parameters with his mom. But with Jesus, he's so gracious. Watch this. He's so great. Here's what Jesus says. He's so gracious that he meets us in our need, in our lack. He doesn't say, well, you know, this is not really spiritual, woman, right? Mom, this is not a spiritual need. They've run out of wine. I am doing the more, you know, this is so beyond, so beneath me, you know. This is not in the Messiah textbook of, you know, miracles, right? To the couple, right, who's, and to the groom especially, who's about to lose his dignity maybe, who's about to get embarrassed in front of all these people. Friends are there, family members are there, in-laws are there, enemies are there. Everyone's there. And he's just about to get the royal embarrassment of his life. And Jesus does not say, oh, this is so beneath me, that need you have, right? How many of you guys think that God is so concerned with only the running universe that he has no concern with your own little need? Jesus was so was as concerned with them just running out of wine. That's a simple thing, right? Just, Lord, I've run out of wine for my party, and can you do something here? That's the God we serve, is that no need of ours is too little for him. It's not insignificant for him. In fact, here's how you can prove why. Jesus doesn't just turn a cup of water into wine. He turns a whole vast 120, 180 gallons of water to wine to last them the whole, and probably leftovers too, you know, for years to come, you know, however long it takes. He provides more than enough, which tells you he's concerned with even the little things that we face. The little things that we think are insignificant in his eyes are not insignificant. By the way, when you pray, pray specifically. Don't just, Lord, I'll provide your grace here. No, Lord, I have this need. I have guests coming over, and I don't have, and you fill in the blank. You be specific with your prayers. God, I need this. I don't know if I should share what happened last week, Sharon, can I share that? Should I share that? No. It's a special thing. But God will do that. He'll answer your prayers. And when you pray specifically, you're like, Lord, I know you're running in the universe, but guess what? You're concerned about me running out of wine. And me running out of songs to sing or something, you know, we're running out of, or whatever. He's so gracious that he gives and he provides more than enough. In fact, this is the theme that will continue on. When he meets the woman in John chapter 4, the woman at the well who leaves her water pot, he says to her, listen, if you can give me a drink from that well, but if you ask me, I'll give you a drink and it'll become a well and within you flowing with water, never ending, right? So abundant supply. When they're in the wilderness, when they're in the, they're out and he's teaching, and there's 5,000 men, probably 15,000 total people, and they've got some boys' lunch, you know, a couple loaves and fish and maybe a Twinkies bar or something, you know, but they didn't have Twinkies back then. Maybe Twinkies last a long time, don't they? With their preserve. Anyway. He feeds them all, right? The whole crowd with just a couple of loaves and fish, and there's 12 leftover baskets. In other words, it speaks to the abundance of God's provision. It's gracious of the Lord to provide, but he doesn't just provide a little. He provides so much, you're like, oh my goodness, this is way more than enough. This is I don't have to worry about thirsting again, she says. I don't have to worry about hungering again, they would say, right? That's how God is. Jesus is overabundant in his generosity, in his grace. Third thing, I'll just get to the third thing. Third thing I want to point out is this. The first thing was that this miracle, this sign points to the greater work of Christ transforming people. That was the first point. Second point was that it points to the ability and character of Jesus. That Jesus would be so gracious and concerned for even their practical, ordinary needs. You know, this wasn't on a Sunday before people. This is on perhaps during the week at a social gathering. Wasn't at church. By the way, Jesus does work throughout every day, right? You don't have to come to church to see Jesus move, right? Jesus, in fact, he says, my Father's working until today. They had a problem with him working on the Sabbath. He goes, my Father's working today and up until today. Like, he doesn't stop working. I'm working. In fact, when John says that so many signs can be written, so many things can be written about all that Jesus did, I imagine that Jesus did something every single day of his ministry life. Every day. It wasn't like once in a while. It was every day God was doing something. But John can only write so many things in his book and only includes particular ones. But the point is that Jesus is continually working every day. So the second point was the ability and character of Jesus, his generosity, his grace, his ability to supply and to change. The third point is this, is that this miracle, this sign, points to the need for us as believers to experience the change that Jesus does in life. It points to the need of believers to experience changes from Jesus. Look at what it says here in verse 11. In this beginning of his signs, Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory. By the way, stop right there. When it says manifested his glory, it means this. Glory usually meant like bright, shiny, you know, glory of God thing in the Old Testament. But it also meant this, a display of God's power and ability. In other words, there are things that you face, you say, that's impossible. How can God fix that, right? I see no way. And time again, God manifests his glory in making a way when there was no way. So Jesus is manifesting his glory, showing his demonstration of not just power, but ability and wisdom and knowledge in doing what he does. And watch this. Look at the result. Look at the result. And, verse 11, his disciples what? Believed him. Believed in him. He displays his power. He does his works. They believe. He does something in their lives. They witness it and they believe. They had already believed, but let's change it around. We see God working and our faith increases, right? When God answers our prayer, our faith increases. When God does something unexpected, our faith increases, does it not? When you see God, okay, how many of you guys have ever prayed prayers like Gideon? Let it be that if you know, let, give me a sign if it's the, you know, the lambs are wet and the ground is dry, then it's from you. And the next day, let it be that the ground's wet, but the wool is dry, right? How many of you guys have prayed those prayers and God has answered them? What has it done to your faith? Shot right up, right? Well, your faith has been encouraged. As believers, we need to experience that. And what helps us out is when we share with one another what God has done, right? I was sharing with a brother recently what God had done, answered certain prayers. And I was telling him details, and he's like, really? Wow, that is... And at the end of the conversation, he's like, wow, John, thanks for sharing that with me. And you could see his faith was increasing. He was excited. So, wow, really? That really helped him out. As believers, that's what we do to encourage one another. We share with each other our burdens, but we also share what God is doing, right? We experience this change from Jesus. It increases our faith. It not only does that, it not only increases our faith as we see Jesus and experience his word, it also increases our intimacy with him. Because then we realize that God is concerned about our needs, right? That he actually has a handle on our life, and we get to trust him and approach him in a closer way, right? This is my prayer for our church, that we would experience the presence of God in such a way and see him work in our lives, that we would be encouraged in our faith, that we can't wait to tell people what he's done, right? That more would come and say, I want to taste what you've been tasting. What do you have there? What are they serving at that church, right? Jesus, right? Not programs, not, you know, smoke machines and whatever. No, if you have smokes, yeah. Jesus, right? Our church is going to be about Jesus. And here's the biggest thing that will bring others to him is that our lives have been changed. And then we can't wait to tell somebody, hey, something's happened to me. Jesus, he's changed my heart in such a way that I can't keep it quiet. You may think I'm a different person, but I'm just the groom who had nothing to do with the change that happened in the wine, right? I'm just a vessel that just was just there. I just happen to be a sit-in, a fill-in, a filler seat at this main event where Jesus is the main attraction, so to speak. He's the main person, but yet he's so behind the scenes that you don't see him. But yet he gets the glory. Does that make sense? I want our church to be such that people experience this change. The healings, the restorations, the fillings, the changed lives. Where people say, I want what you have. I want the Jesus that you have. I want to taste and see that he is good.